My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome back into the studios. It's this week's episode of the DTD Podcast, and we have a great one for you. Welcome into the studio, Dan Horgan. How are you, my friend?
DJ, I'm doing great. Sorry, I was taking a sip there. Normally, I'd be in bed almost about this time. Yeah.
Well, we have a lot to talk about with your career. I mean, 24 years with the Air Force, Baltimore Police Department. You worked a presidential detail. You've worked on AWACS. You've worked TAC-P. You've worked with JTACs. You've done narcotics. You've done all kinds of stuff. So we really have to get into the meat of it. My first question to you is, you really don't like being stagnant or staying in one place at all, do you?
No, not at all. I'll use the word radical transparency probably many times throughout tonight talking with you. I actually was just talking to my wife, where I'm at currently and what I'm doing and just, you know, how I'm feeling. And she just gives me this look every time.
She knows when it's coming, when the move's getting ready to happen.
Yeah. Or just, you know, the how I'm feeling. And she I use her. We've been married 22 years. So she's a good counterbalance for me. Kind of bring you back down there sometimes, but yeah, I gotta find just that thing, and sometimes that thing is hard to describe.
Does it have anything to do with your childhood? Does it have anything to do with the careers that you've chosen? I'm really interested in it because as I look through, man, you ran the spectrum in not only the military, in police work, and what you're doing now.
No, childhood, only child, right? So most people who know me probably be like, that makes sense. My mother raised me. My dad was around, but I lived with my mom. I mean, I went to an all boys sport coat and tie high school. My mother worked two jobs, put me through a private high school in Maryland, Calvert Hall. In 1989, when I graduated, my tuition was like $3,500. And I think now it's like $25,000 a year for high school. Yeah. So I did. And then I joined the Air Force, but no, I mean, I wasn't abused and had really happy memories. I mean, it was really normal.
Well, let's talk about that because you joined in the Air Force. You said it very nonchalantly. I graduated and I joined the Air Force. There's a little more to the story about that. You went to college, kind of followed a girl around. That didn't quite work out. And then the Air Force came along. So let's talk about that a little bit. Going to college, not really kind of finding your fit there once again, kind of moving around and then following this girl. You got to tell us what was so important about this girl that made you go with her.
We actually still follow each other on Instagram. Tara's her name. I graduated from Calvert Hall. My best friend went to VMI, you know, and some other guys stayed there in Maryland and went to school. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but what I thought I wanted to do, and this is, I've written about it on my LinkedIn stuff, is I wanted to write for Marvel Comics, right? So this is 89, this is going into 90, so Marvel Comics still, comic books are a thing. So I went to the University of Bridgeport, up in Connecticut, and in high school, I was probably a C, like a 2.5 student. I got up to Connecticut that semester, was on the dean's list, so I had like a 3 or 3.5. I actually wrote for the college newspaper. This other girl and I had a section in the college newspaper called the writer's block. And we wrote, but it just, you know, yeah, I missed my girlfriend. And I said, man, I had friends, but it's just like, even like now, it wasn't the same. There was always something. And, you know, at that point you can make decisions. And I was like, I don't want to be here. And so I finished out the semester and came back and, you know, yeah. And then, so that would have been around December, come back and going to Essex Community College there in Maryland. And the Air Guard is nearby. And so A-10s were always flying overhead. Tara and I broke up. And I just remember sitting like in the student lounge waiting, doing some classes, and you can see these A-10s flying overhead. And I was like, let's do that. So I literally walked into the recruiter on my own, because my mother would tell you, she's still around. My mom's still alive. Like, I went in and I signed up, and then came home and was like, I just joined the Air Force.
That's always a reason. Now, it makes so much sense when you say that. First off, I got to ask, do you remember the reason that you guys broke up?
No, we were kids. What was I, 18 and 17? Yeah, we were kids. And we dated. I mean, we were serious. That was a serious year, right? Senior year. No, wasn't anything. No cheating or anything.
Right. When you describe it that way.
I think she broke out with me though. So, because I was that kid where I wrote poetry for all the breakups, and I got a book still somewhere in a box. So I
This
think
is
she.
your chance to let tens of people know that you broke up with her. You just because,
No.
when you say that though, it's so funny when you say that and you talk about breaking up and then sitting there and looking at planes, flying overhead, and you're like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. It reminds me of other parts of your career where you're 9, 10 years in, something doesn't happen a way that you thought it was going to happen, and you're like, you know what? I'm just going to get out. I'm going to do this. Have you always been on those snap decisions? And I want to know if they've ever kind of bitten you making those snap decisions, or has it always worked out pretty well for you doing it?
That is a good one. You are on it. I think this year, honestly, as I sit, I look up and I'm thinking, I think this year nothing has bitten me, but I just talked about it. I think yesterday and today on my LinkedIn, I've made some decisions where I should have taken a lot more time. So like I was with a beer company, as their, I go air quote, their CMO 67 days into it. And I was like, I'm out. Right, went into some sales and I was like out. And so I think it's been more recent. None of the decisions I made before this year, I think were so just jumbled and like hopping. Military career though, you kind of have to though. That's why a lot of people talk about the military. I went from the Honor Guard up to Minot, North Dakota. I mean, I had no choice, right? You have no choice. But I was doing a job though that I liked. I was security police. There was security police right back in the day, not security forces. That's what, 93 to 95 up there. But again, I made the decision then, okay, I don't like Minot. How do I, what is the system? What's within the rules, and then I could cross train. I had a line number for a staff sergeant. And so they said E4s with line numbers can, pull E5 slots. So boom, put in a, that's how I got on the AWACS. So put it there, get me out. Same thing. So when I was AWACS was getting really boring after about 4 years, and I was just flying missions at Tinker left and right. And then the recruiters came up, not the recruiters, the drill instructors, the TIs, but again, you do something like there, and that's where that decision, as we go down rabbit holes, get accepted, the career field won't let you go, then yes, then I make a decision like, well, I'm going to get out, but I just end up staying in the reserve. So I still stayed and did things like that. And so that's why even this year, when you really hit that question, I think this year in my life, this has been, I made a bunch of people were, I had a lot of comments. Like I posted on Sunday. I don't know if you saw it. I posted on Sunday just about, the job hopping, because I was reading another article and then I talked about how this year alone I'm on my fourth one, right? But what I none of them bit me though. Like there was always something. Like even when I had the in between, I was looking for a job for about 7 weeks, right? But financially we were planned for it and stuff like that, so it was fine. I mean, at 7 weeks I was getting a little nervous. But again, yeah, just things kind of happen and yeah, it worked out.
Well, and as you get older, you get a little wiser, because I think that you thought once you got out and moved into the area that you're in, that these companies were just going to snatch you up. Why wouldn't they snatch you up? And I think that there is merit to having, that goal going forward. Why would they not want me? Because you're really competing against people that have degrees in marketing, have all these kind of things, and you bring that thing that the military instills in so many of its soldiers and airmen and Marines and stuff, that it doesn't matter. We'll get the job done no matter what it takes. And I think throughout your career, you have told a lot of people that you work for, I'll get the job done, including, higher ranking command staff that has talked to you about the big and the small things, which we'll get into a little bit later.
Sure.
But I think you've always kind of brought that into your jobs. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it is. You know, and it's when you hit that, I would tell you, and I'll talk about it. I normally don't mention like Evan and Black Rifle too often, but the things that I learned, saw, observed, like the OJT that Evan and the whole Black Rifle team taught me about marketing, like I can't put down on paper. And, you know, I think I've said it, you know, I've talked to a few other people and it does sound very egotistical. That's why I try not to, because I don't like how it sounds, but there's no other way. It's just like the things that I did in those 3.5 years, I would really stack up against those marketing degrees or someone that has, you know, I would almost say dog years. I wouldn't say 20 years, but like I would say my 3.5 years at BRCC in the marketing branding world, I'd put it into, you know, a 7-10 year veteran, you know, who was into marketing. Just at the level, the pace alone for Black Rifle was crazy. Good. Again, I was with Evan, you know, Matt, JT, Logan, Richard, Ryan. I was with these guys like in their pockets and hearing things. And again, seeing, observing, which is all on the job training. And, you know, then eventually, you know, Evan moved me into there. And then now I'm doing events, you know, sponsorships, partnerships, and things like that, you know, on a level with companies now where, you know, it sounds like you're name dropping, but it's just, you know, that was the level of connections that Evan made that I then, you know, had to work. I mean, from, you know, Everly Stock, Kafaru, you know, Montana Knife Company, yeah, list rattles on, Bass Pro, right? I mean, stuff like that.
Well, and that's the way it works. So let's go back into your career a little bit. I really want to talk about it because your Air Force career, it seems very fluid in everything that you did. You started out wanting to be pararescue, and they told you, you're blind as shit. There's no way.
Yep.
I can't imagine that you were that blind. I mean, is it that bad? I can't tell it because your eyes don't look any bigger in the screen right now. So, yeah,
well, I'm old now. I have glasses again. I had a solid 15, almost 16 years where I had PRK done. And so I was at 20/20, but that was 2001. No, I was 2400. So 2400 is, I think, the E on the eye chart, the really big E. So the BCGs that I had in, what, 1990? Yeah, no, they were super thick.
You decide that you're going to go special. I don't know how they say it in the Air Force. It's military police, but they call it something else.
So, well, back in the day, so again, 1990, security police is what it was called. And so security police in the Air Force was broken up into two segments. You had law enforcement and security. So you had your gate guards, you know, and then you had people out in like where I went to the missile field and stuff like that. And so you had the security specialists.
And did they do like the military does where they answer calls on post and they have that law enforcement perspective of where they do actual law enforcement police duties, not just security?
Yeah, law enforcement did now. And I couldn't tell you when it changed because I know I became security forces like when I got out. So in 2001, so maybe somewhere around like 2000 or 99 or something, the Air Force changed it and it became security forces. So the law enforcement and the security are now one. There's all security forces, how you get them broken up. But yeah, I mean, they're driving around like in their cars, and which is, you know, 25 miles an hour or so on a base.
In the time that you join, you're looking at kind of a hot Europe time frame. That's where kind of the major stuff is happening. But the Middle East starts to come up. You have Desert Storm, all those kind of things.
Well, I joined in November. Yeah, so it would have been November of 90. No, not 90. Yeah, 90. Yeah, 90. Because I joined in 91. Yeah. So it was November of 90. And then on a delayed enlistment, I went to basic training in February. And Desert Storm kicked off in January of 90.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as you go in, it's been not a peaceful world, but as you go in, you're now seeing that shift to armed combat. And, and of course, like we said, there's things going on before. Is this what you were looking for, or did you think, this is not what I signed up for?
No, well, I definitely wasn't thinking that. I always have been that guy, right? I mean, from the police to my end career with being a tech, being a JTAC, like kind of running into danger. I mean, sounds so cliche, but no. So I was fine with it. I mean, if I would have joined a little sooner and went the basic, I mean, I probably would have deployed. Like right out of after I came, you know, went through the, you know, academy there for the Air Force, I probably would have been over there.
So I asked that question to ask this.
Yep.
of course we know that you weren't, man, this isn't what I signed up for. So now are you disappointed? Because one, you wanted to go PJ. That doesn't happen. So right. You go police. Then you go in. You see us go to war. And you're pretty much just hanging out guarding things.
And that actually, you look at that little piece and you fast forward through like a timeline when I'm singing at Andrews Air Force Base after 9/11 and I'm just checking IDs and looking for bombs on cars and I'm not in the war. I mean, right? I just got pulled from my cozy bank job I had and now here I am checking IDs and I'm like, well, I'm not in Afghanistan. Like, what are we doing? What are you talking about? And that's why I then ended up going through like the Raven program that the Air Force has just because I was like, I have to do something more. And then even at that level, step it up. I got my Baltimore shirt on. You know, I was with people because it was the reserve. So I was with, you know, there were crews that were from Virginia and like Jersey down. And a lot of them were like, were cops. They were Jersey State Troopers, Virginia State Troopers. My one partner, he was a DC cop. So I was like, all right. And then that's why I applied for Baltimore when I was doing that. Because I was like, okay. Let's go be a real cop.
Which, completely different worlds. I think they mesh with each other, but they're completely different worlds. And I'm glad, though, that you say that because I really want to look into this career that you did because SWAT, narcotics, you did patrol, but you were around when Wayne Jenkins, who was in your academy class, was around. They've made documentaries about that and stuff. So we're going to get into that. But as you transfer over, you go to Baltimore, you become a cop, you're still military, but there's not really any time that you've spent in a forward area. Now, Baltimore, that's a forward area, right?
They are, yeah. And I mean, and I wasn't in any forward. I deployed in 98, but it was Saudi Arabia. And again, it was AWACS. I was at Prince Sultan Air Base. I mean, I was living in a tent, but it definitely, you know, we weren't getting shot at, right? There was no incoming rounds or anything like that. So, but yeah, up until, yeah, then, yeah, my Baltimore time, which again, now when I talk about deploying in 11, I had already been to SWAT school and everything. And I mean, and not to say, not that I wasn't scared, but Baltimore prepared me for my deployment. Like, I mean, it was, I mean, I was okay.
Let's talk about that AWAC deployment a little bit. As you're doing that, once again, we go back to the idea that, okay, now you've been deployed to the Middle East. But now you're flying overhead, you're watching things, you're in, I'm not going to say the safety of an aircraft, because by no means is that safety over there. But I still don't think it's the level that you want it at.
No, I mean, it was exciting because, again, Operation Southern Watch, right? So you have the border and AWACS, it's radar and IFF dots. And so anything that's a radar dot, right, at that point, the career fields were broken up. But I could talk to a weapons director and a weapons director was talking to a plane. So if some plane would have been coming at us, because nothing was, it had to be another plane who was going to shoot at us, we would intercept. I mean, you know, we would evade and then, you know, we'd have other, you know, fighters come in. So that was cool. But yeah, like that was about it. But nothing that, again, they weren't going to do with that.
As you get into Baltimore, because I want to kind of go back and forth with the military, because they really get kind of meshed up in your career right now, back and forth. Baltimore, let's talk about you getting out of the academy, starting your first day. Now, this is, if it's anything like my first day, because I was big city too whenever I get out of the academy, it opened up my eyes like they've never been opened. And the only way I can describe it to people is I tell them, until you've seen it, until you've been there, you can't really understand what I'm telling you. Like, you can laugh at the stories or you can be nervous about the stories, but you can't understand it until you've seen it. Feel the same way once you hit the streets?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I started in the Eastern District. I mean, I almost really even finished in the Eastern District. The citywide, when I did narcotics, I stayed on the East Side. You know, Baltimore City, I don't know the population, but I can tell you definitely the Eastern District for Baltimore City. I mean, it's, you know, 99%, you know, black. I'm a skinny little white kid from the county. I mean, it is eye-opening just to a level of like, where am I? And we had to walk, that they really were starting foot patrol. So we walked foot patrol even for a few months, you know, and that's like, not that it's the worst, but you are just, you know, like you're in it. But that's where when I talk about, and I'll get really passionate, when I talk about my time in Baltimore, I loved every minute of it. And I love being in the cities. I love inner cities, right? Do I like smells of urine? Nope, right? I don't like the crime, but most of the crime too, right? If you're not in that spot, it's, not happening to you. Like right now, me being here in San Antonio, like I drive downtown 3 days a week to go work, and I mean the homeless population is crazy, and you're just like, man. And but again, I don't see anything like when I was in Baltimore. Like again, then you're talking a time frame. This is 2003 to 2010. So, the heroin trade and the open air drug markets were just, again, crazy is the only word I can, it was on every corner there were, drug deals going down. I still have friends on an apartment. I don't know. I don't think it's as bad, but I don't know. But when I come here, like to San Antonio, like I don't see what I saw in Baltimore.
And once again, though, you're not doing that kind of job. So, of course, you're not going to see
I don't
to
know
that
though.
level.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm looking. I always still have the eyes. Like I'm looking at, if I see people walking, I'm always looking at their hands, seeing if I see anything going on, walking into an alley looking for a stash.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I absolutely loved working where I did when I got out of the academy. I loved it sounds crazy when you say it and stuff, but I loved the people where I was at. I loved the mentality because when you looked at it, you could see that like it was a lifestyle. It was a way of life that until, like I said, you've been there and seen it, you can't understand it.
Oh yeah. Well, and I would even tell you, like, I think policing in general, to I mean, it's kind of a soapbox too, but it's just the atmosphere of I had to put on a bulletproof vest and load up my gun every day to go to work, not carry my bag and my other laptop into the office. A bulletproof vest and a loaded gun, right, to go to work, right? And people, like, I think we look at law enforcement and you're like, yeah, look, oh, blah, 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 they're bad, whatever stuff. But you're like, I put on a bulletproof vest and a gun to go into, and I say enemy territory, I don't mean it bad, but right, to go in and enforce, right, serve and protect, but also enforce laws, especially when it comes to narcotics. And this point now, again, you're taking away someone's livelihood, right? Selling drugs is their job. This is what they have to do. And now I'm trying to stop them. Yeah, it's not friendly.
I had always heard a crazy thing when someone was running from you when you were chasing someone. They're running for their life. You're just running after them. I want to ask you, though, with all of this, you haven't really seen this kind of action. Is there any kind of mental stuff that comes up, any stress that comes from it, anything that maybe hasn't gone in your family or in your marriage or anything like that that has kind of popped its head up?
Yes. I don't know, though, again, if it would be from, my military, because again, Afghanistan, losing friends, and explosions and being in firefights. I was never shot at in Baltimore. So my whole time in all the search warrants even that I've done, right? And we were doing like one a week, and these are all drug houses. I never got shot at, right? But Afghanistan, definitely getting shot at, right? Almost getting blown up. Had a 60 round hit 15 feet from me in a firefight. Stuff like that didn't happen to me in Baltimore. Scary stuff happened, right? Fights and knives and things like that. But I was pretty lucky that I never got shot at. But the things that I saw, like, I've seen a guy's teeth out on the ground because he got shot in the crown of his head. Well, that wasn't an accidental shot. We know that obviously was probably an execution. So, not many people get to see things like that. And then just even the drug trade, what it does to, addicts, the sores all over them, and people living in vacant houses, like it's yeah, that all plays definitely a toll. I think I do a pretty good job handling it lately, though. I tell you again, it's just kind of even now lately. I think a lot of between the military and the police, like some of that just kind of catches up.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. Going back into your career, military career, because we're kind of going back and forth. Is there anything that stood out to you in your career in the military that made you want to do these other things? Because at this time, I think you've done AWACS and everything, but you haven't gone over to TAC-PE, JTACS, anything like that. What was it that made you want to change over? Now, you had done, if I'm correct, you had done the Raven School, correct? So you were already doing security for the planes and stuff.
And which was a nice little school. It was, what it was about 2 weeks, I think, up in Fort Dix, New Jersey. But it was legit. Like, so in the police academy, we get asked, we had to ask that training, because I had already been, so that's 2003 when I'm in the academy. I had gone to Raven School in 2002, No, Raven School, literally, we had four guys in red man suits attack us at once to beat the shit out of us. Versus in the academy, we were, just hitting the bag with your partner. No. So Raven School was 100% legit when it came to a lot of that. But what helped me too, I found the academy, like we were going over verbal judo. Well, the Raven School taught you verbal judo as well. So I already had that class going into the academy. Yeah, no, it was just once I made it through the academy, like, I'm out on the street and patrol is great. Did my 2 years minimum patrol and then bump over to a SET team, a special enforcement team there in the Eastern District. But it was 2007. So now you're looking at what, 4 years, ask them there. I just, yeah, like Baltimore, the level of adrenaline, right? Knowing that I'm still in shape, I mean, because I'm running, right? I'm running down suspects. So I'm looking like, okay, like I can't keep doing security forces. And I was missing drills even too on the reserve side. Like, so I have 24 years, but I think I only have 21 good years for my guard retirement. The TACP units. Yeah. So I just happen to be like how I always am, searching for something. And I find that a TACP unit just stood up at Fort Indiantown Gap, which is about an hour, what, hour and a half north of Baltimore. So I call those guys up. I'm like, hey, I want to join. They're like, great. So you had to do an assessment. So I was like, cool. So I go up there and I do all this PT assessment, right? Pass it, interview, right? One of the peer interviews. I'm a likable guy. So I passed that and they're like, great, you're in. I was the sixth guy hired, number six in the unit. We were on the bombing range up there at Fort Indiantown Gap, the close air support, the range that they have. And we were literally a 2 mile tank trail up to a trailer was our office.
Well, yeah, because they're just building the unit up.
Yeah.
How's it like to be on that ground level of that?
It was phenomenal. That unit's the 148th Air Support Operations Squadron up there at Fort Indiantown Gap. That's one of those, and it's like my black rifle time too. That's one of those recipes, one of those units where it is just awesome. Like, but you don't know what it is. Like, it just is. Like, even the guys were like, there's always like one or two guys that like you don't get along with, but like even them, they don't ruin it. And like it was just, like, so I was there 3 years and I left in 2010 and came to Oklahoma. It was just phenomenal. It was crazy.
I want to ask you something. I want to play devil's advocate for a minute
Yeah.
with you. So don't take offense to the question. I want to ask, though. Some people would say when you move so quickly through jobs, when you move so quickly through AWACS or security police or the police department with 7 years, that you don't really get the understanding. You don't really feel what the guys that have put in time after time, deployment after deployment, combat after combat. What would you say to something like that? Because you're moving around, you're constantly learning, but do you think you're getting the full kind of spectrum that you could get if you were to stay longer?
Yes and no. Like I can talk about like the police. So Baltimore, 7 years. Yeah, 7 years of Baltimore. Again, I got friends up, in Oklahoma, not Oklahoma City, but some of the suburbs. I had four search warrants as a patrol kid in 2 years. There's guys in patrol who don't have any search warrants. And I was coming with, I already had four under my belt. So again, when I look at now other bigger departments, sure, like it's super comparable. But at that point too, like again, the units that I were in and the stuff I did, like it just would have kept rolling. Or I just would have made sergeant, right? Like my really good friend Adam's a captain now in one of the districts, right?
I've
A
got a guy
captain.
that was in my academy class that's a chief now.
So no, I don't think that would have my military time, not really either, too. I don't think, like security police, when I did 2 years in Minot, I mean it was the missile field. Like I'm not some Einstein genius, but like I had already gone to the pinnacle of, right, what I was going to do. Like I'd been to, even prior to that, when I did the Presidential Honor Guard, I had done two police competitions for the Air Force. It used to be called Peacekeeper Challenge. So it was all the MAJCOMs got together. I did that twice already. So it's like I had already done things. AWACS was the same way. I did AWACS for 4 years. I don't know how many hours I had. I had over 1,000, I think, because I was an experienced flyer. So I only had to fly once a month. So I only needed 8 hours. So like I was already experienced. At that point, then what do you become? Like an instructor. And then you become an evaluator. Well, what are those guys doing? I'm not making fun of evaluators, but like now you're just evaluating all the other kids. And you're just, Now, I think my military and police time, I would as it already sounds like, I would defend that. Now, I would say, though, like my other times, like marketing and things, could have stayed longer. You know, I could have, you know, stayed another maybe year or something, a Black Rifle and got something. But I think where I was at, again, it was just time for me to spread my wings, you know, and that's where this, and then even prior to getting with Black Rifle, what I did in Oklahoma, we left, it really wasn't my choice. I mean, I'm a mill spouse. My wife is still in, and that's what brought us from Oklahoma down here. So if we wouldn't have moved, you know, from Oklahoma to down here for her orders, I'd still be probably at that gig up there, the aviation company.
I guess the question that I would tag on to that again was, do you worry about being stagnant then?
Yeah, I do. I'll be 52 here next month in September. And even at 52, my dad died in his mid early 70s. My mom's 72. Her health is so-so. I mean, so if I'm a realist and I'm like, okay, so I have another 25 years, right? Just like, that's still a lifetime. So like, that's why I'm not like, yeah, I don't want to stay stagnant. And I want to think about retirement, but it's just like, what am I doing? And even in retirement, I couldn't even imagine what, just not doing anything.
Well, and that's kind of the question that I get to, because we talk about PTS, but there is one on the other end of that spectrum too, where we talk about people that they have the stress from doing those jobs for so long. But then you have some of the people, and I think this might be what you worry about, that are around 30, 35, 40, 45, 50 years in these jobs. I mean, we have a guy where I work that has 50 years on. He put his 50th year bar on. And you think on the opposite end of that, and that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, was there's nothing left then.
Yeah.
Like you say, I can't imagine retirement, but I don't think they can either. So there's a stagnancy, and then there's a scared to go away and it just to be a calm, normal life.
Yeah. Well, you kind of get institutionalized, right? It's the Shawshank Redemption. You get institutionalized and you just want to stay in prison. And I'm not saying the military is even prison, but what was the old Friends episode, right? I just want to quit the gym. Was it Friends? Yeah. Or is it Seinfeld?
I watch Friends. No, it's Friends. Yeah.
It's Friends. I just want to quit the gym and you can't. But I would, but police though, that's a thing though too. I'd honestly tell you, it was really the, so I had a 380 and wrecked, put to the back of my head. And that's when my wife was like, okay, eventually that's when you were done. But to this day, I mean, being a cop in Baltimore was one of the best times. I mean, I loved it. And, you know, but again, you have to, like, there's certain things you had to go. Or, you know, I wouldn't be with my wife still.
Absolutely. But yeah. Even when you talk about that, because I've heard you talk about that story before, and right. I think about, why would you tell your wife that? Why would you not wait until it was all over to say that? Danger's done. The story's out of the way. Why not hold on to that until later on? Maybe not until the end of your career, but a more approachable time where you can say, there was some crazy stuff that I didn't tell you about. Is it because you want them to be a part of that? Is it because you want them to understand? What is it about that kind of story that you tell them? Because ultimately that tells you it's time to step away.
Yeah, no, I've shared every story with her, which again goes to what you're asking. No, I just did. I don't know. It was just, you know, like I've been even when I was in patrol the first 2 years, we had a stolen Explorer hit an officer down in the block, right? Hurt him pretty severe. But all of a sudden the car chase comes to me and I'm just sitting in my patrol car. But sure enough, the chase comes, guy hits me right on my door, right? Window shatters, you know, crystallizes, you know, but I, right then and there, I had to call her once I was sitting in the ambulance because they were afraid I had glass in my eye, right? So I'm like, hey, right, I'm okay. So she usually got, again, Afghanistan's the same way. So when I got in that firefight and that 60 round hit, I didn't die, obviously. But she got a call being like, have you heard about Dan already? They're like, she's like, what? And I didn't have a chance to tell her. So I think every time, like, she's always known. She knows everything.
Going back to that, is that because you want them to be part of that world? Or is it just because it makes you feel better about the situation? Because I think that's two totally different things. You'd agree, right?
I think it is. I think it makes me feel better because then you don't bottle it up. Like I probably already have, Yeah, I probably already have so much other stuff bottled up, and then sharing it with her, right? Her being, you know, like my wife, best friend, but just, you know, to share it. Same thing. I hit my arm once chasing a robbery suspect on a wire, lost feeling in my hand. It was also to explain why I wasn't coming home one time. I'm not a really good liar. So all those times, like, we usually were staying out like till like 4 a.m., like the squad. And so I had to like, and that was always a good, like, hey, I deserve to be out, right? I can't feel my hand. I almost had my head blown off. Yeah, I'm going to be late.
Here's what's crazy about you to me, and I've kind of hinted around to it, but when you talk about, like, you maybe have some PTS or you maybe have this or that, that's still bottled up. When you talk about every phase of your life, even when you talk about your mom raising you, your dad kind of came around a little bit, it doesn't seem to affect you. It seems like you put a happy spin on it, which and by all means, I'm not saying that's the wrong way to do it, but I feel like there's no bad point in your life because you just say, oh, well, and if you look at this, this is good. And if you look at this, so I wonder, are you just, you know, that optimist, that always optimist person, or are you looking at it that way because that's what helps keep you moving forward?
I think I look at it that way to keep me moving forward because, you know, but there's, you know, my wife and I have done counseling, which I would talk about, but it's just not one of those. I'm a sharer in stories, and I will bring it up now, but I don't share like a lot of that. I mean, and we were that 2010, 2011, like coming from Baltimore into Oklahoma, leaving the police department. Oh, razor's edge of divorce just before the, you know, again, it was definitely PTS, but like all of that. But I hadn't deployed yet. So that was stuff from the police. You know, the military hadn't been too crazy at that point. You know, and then again, so now bottle that up and now sprinkle in, let's go to Afghanistan and fight in wars, the JTAC, you know, with my army unit. Yeah, it was, now there's times, but I try like to laugh. That's the thing though. Like, so right now I'm at a 30% rating, appealing, because I do think it could be higher, but because I really am starting to see, like, even from this year, this job hopping, because my wife has asked, like, well, she's like, is that part of PTS? And I was like, not that I don't know, but it's like, I don't know, but I'm like, but it's getting bad because I'm really trying to assimilate into like these groups. And it's not like I'm not getting fired. I mean, the outdoor company, yes, they laid me off, but that was just because of the remote work, right? They're in Pennsylvania and I'm in San Antonio. But it's like, I am literally just not like, you just feel lost.
And that, yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because that is the most interesting part about you to me. And of course, it's social media, you know, that's what you're kind of an expert in marketing and stuff like that. And everyone always says Facebook perfect world and things like that. But when I look at you and I see the stories and stuff, there's always at least a happy spin to the end of them. But when you change it and you say, you know, that razor's edge from coming from Baltimore down to, I think you came to Oklahoma then, right?
Yep.
So you come down there. You're not doing the job. I'm not sure in what I've heard you talk about the police department, heard what you've said about what you were doing, that you were quite ready to be done there yet.
No, I definitely wasn't. I didn't want to leave, you know, by any means, but again, it was a family decision. But at that point too, I was a TACP and I had my JTAC qual. So it was great. I mean, I make the joke that we left in 2010 and I deployed to Afghanistan in 2011. So for my wife, I say the joke, it's not funny, but I was like, you know, I got you, because I wasn't, you know, especially because my best friend Brad and I were in TACP school together. Brad was killed in January of 2010. I was still in Baltimore in December, and so, which was December 09, right there. So in December, Brad's going to Afghanistan, but he's stuck at BWI, calls me. And I'm like, yeah, like it's a slow night. You know, I was doing narcotics, so you kind of got a flexible schedule. And I look at my sergeant and yeah, he's like, yeah, Dan, go. So I go down to BWI, pick Brad up. I take him out to, you know, our cop bar there in Canton, Maryland. And we hang out and then I take him back. And then, you know, he flies to Afghanistan. And then 30 days later, you know, he's blown up. So that gets me right. And then I left in October of 2010 is when I left the Baltimore Police Department. I then deployed, what, around, I don't know, I can't remember, like April, March of 11. I'm in the same area as Brad. So, and when I say the area, like I was in the area, like the FOB that I was at, I was in his tent. So I had a huge chip on my shoulder to get out there and do some work.
Let's talk about something too, though, with that, with him dying. I've heard you even talk about before that funerals are different to you because of being on the presidential detail, that they yep. kind of hit a little different for you. They touch you in a way that most people might not see it. The way I look at when you did it is I would almost think that you were numb to them, but I don't think it's that way. I think it went to the other end of the spectrum for you.
It did for Brad. It was really bad. Like, it's almost one of those 9/11 things. Like, hey, where were you when 9/11 happened? Like the day that I got notified, right? That, you know, that morning, I can tell you exactly. I mean, I was in Eastern District Court. I had drug court, and my phone, you know, buzzed off, and I walked out the hallway, take it, you know, and I get the notification, you know, that Brad is dead. I can't even. I walk back into the DA, assistant DA, and I'm like, my friend just died. I'm out. I'm like, I don't care what you do with any of these cases. Like, I got to go. And they're like, okay. My wife, again, so my Bethany, she's working at the Maryland Guard. So she's working for like the general or the colonel. He'd kill me. I can't remember. But the A-10 squadron, right, to the wing. And so they actually were like, come to base now and we'll get on the phone. And so I was actually, yeah, that morning able then, and right after that, I drove down to the Air Guard base there in Baltimore, and they were great, and then got all that. No, it's just, even to this day, right, it's just one of those, he's got a daughter, Chloe, you know, and she's growing up, and you see all that, and you're just like, it's just, you know. And my story is my story. Like, I feel like almost every military guy and gal has that. And you're just, yeah. And most people don't. But I mean, but people lose other people too. Like, I can go down, like, I can sit and get real deep, and we all lose people. But I think it's, you know, the way you lose them and just, yeah, and how you bonded.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it goes back to that thing where we talked about, where if you haven't been through that kind of stuff, you can't understand that. Of course, people lose people. But when you say that and you say it this way, it puts a whole new spin to your story. And that's what I'm saying, is that this is a side that I've never heard from you, that I've never seen. And it's, I want people to see that.
Yeah,
exactly. But I want people to understand that they're, because I think people look at law enforcement or first responders, military, and they go, oh, that's a happy guy. There's nothing going on. They're perfectly fine. There's nothing that we need to worry about. And they need to understand that there's a lot of stuff that's sitting right there underneath the surface that maybe hasn't come up, that maybe hasn't been talked about, or maybe, and I'm going to put this, a dark humor is, and you know from being in the military and law enforcement, there's a dark humor that gets a lot of people through the stuff. My wife was an ER nurse for 20 years of our marriage. That dark humor is there to get you through it. But there's stuff on the other side that people need to worry about. And I think you deal with that now by helping the veterans that you help out and working with the organizations that you work with.
Yeah, no, I mean, I try to. And, you know, my wife said it for years, too. I mean, you got to remember, my deployment was 2011. But there were subtle things, and there's even things now. I haven't touched my checkbook since 2011. So prior to my deployment, I literally was the guy who was in your checkbook ledger. Like, I was doing that. I mean, like, OCD, right? But when I deployed, I had to give it to her. And I'm being like, not even making it up, because she would tell you, she could have $1 million squirreled away in some secret account. I wouldn't have a clue. So it's from 2011 to now. Like,
that one's one that I don't understand that one. So tell me, is it just that it's not worth it being OCD about it, or you just, it's a smaller thing in life?
You just, it's like, when you look at PTS, you know, they always say like one of them, or the symptoms or something too, is like losing interest. And you would think that it's losing interest in something like that's fun, but like losing interest in, and yeah, right. But
what are you saying? Looking through a checkbook is not fun. Come on, my friend.
Losing interest just in and giving a shit about the finances. Like I know how much I need to make to pay our bills, stuff like that. Like, but I don't. Yeah, no idea. Yeah. I don't know. It just, you know, and it was a level of, I gave it up. I mean, and to take it back on, like, yeah, I mean, she could have been like, all right, you're home, you got it. But she wasn't. She was rocking and rolling with it, you know, and she's great with it. But I can tell you, I don't know why. But like, again, it's also not normal. Like, I can't imagine like why. I mean, when I came back, yeah, it was just like, nope.
Anything else that you changed in your life that you were visibly noticed about it? That, because I think that even as small as that is, that stood out very much to you in your world. Was there anything else that when you came back or when you ended these careers and kind of got into your civilian life that you went, wow, I either did that and that was a crazy thing I did, or man, I'm glad I don't do that anymore.
No, I loved it. And I still want to do exciting stuff. And trust me, like even working at PAPS now, like they reached out to me, but you know, I think that's a concern. And I'd say it's a valid concern for any of the companies post Black Rifle. Is just like, are you going to be happy? Like, you're not getting shot at, like, right? You're not running and gunning. Like, there's nothing scary here, you know? So what's going to keep you happy? And for me, it's just even a team. Like, I think the people that you're around can be, you know, happy. Like, I mean, I was stationed in Minot. Minot was horrible, right? I say horrible just because, I mean, it was, you know, 3 feet of snow. It was negative 94 with the wind chill the 1 year. But I had friends there. My daughter was born there, right? I mean, there's still a lot of those pluses. And so now when I look at back on it, you know, I don't know, I that's where I still am. Like, so I'm in my garage office, you know, I have all my archery stuff here. We have three paddle boards and a kayak. So I got to keep one of the paddle boards, you know, in here, my bows up there and stuff. And I don't know.
Well, like let's that. Talk about your daughter being born, because I think that's another interesting point about your life and your career. Reliability is a big thing with you. You talk about it a lot. Reliability, yeah. Being where you're supposed to be, taking care of what you're supposed to take care of. Your daughter was born and 12 hours later, you were back at work. No time off for you. No doing anything. Why is that reliability? Why was it at that time so important to you? Because that's a pretty momentous occasion in your life. And is it still that important to you now?
It is. I mean, I didn't have a choice. Like, so I was working, it's called what used to be, again, I don't even know what it is now, because this is, what is that, 95. So it was the Keys and Codes Control Center. So I was in an office where I issued out the authenticator stuff for the guys that had to go out to the field. I was out in the field and I ended up, you know, getting a nice cushy job a little bit there. So I was doing that. Yeah, we were 12-hour shifts, so like I didn't have a choice. Like I literally got like an extra few hours from my daughter being born, but yeah, like that was all they were like, hey, we can give you like 2 or 3 hours. I forget what it was. And they're like, but you got to come back in. So I just got off a 12-hour shift. My ex-wife, right, my wife at the time, Angela, Angie's like, I think I'm in labor. And I was like, go back to bed, right? Sarah's born, and they're like, all right, well, you got to come into work. No, I mean, my three boys that I have now are teenagers with, you know, and well, youngest will be 11, and then you got 16 and 19. They, you know, I've missed some stuff with them because, again, even at that point, I was doing contract work in Afghanistan, and so I'd be gone 60 days or 90 days, and then home, you know, 30 or 60 days, and you know that was great money, but again, it got to the point of this isn't worth it, and you know, and Bethy and I, my wife, we've struggled with, you know, I take the job. And it becomes me. And Black Rifle was that. So the 3.5 years I was there, I mean, I was just like when I was in Baltimore or just like when I was at TACP, like it was me. It was my persona, right? Like it was everything and it consumed me, which I don't see as a bad thing. But when we talk about the kids, it is, because you end up taking every trip, whether it's a mandatory trip or not. And, you know, and because you don't want to miss out on anything. To whereas now, really trying to find, like, I don't truly like just working from home. Like, I need some happy medium, right? I need some people because I can't be by myself, but I also love the freedom right now, my 11-year-old, or soon to be 11-year-old, is not, you know, in back in school yet. It's like next week, and you know, I had to work today, and you know, we can see our neighborhood pool. We're like right behind the pool, and there's like nobody at the pool. And he's like, "Hey, let's go to the pool." And I want to be like, "Yeah, great, let's go." But you know, I had stuff that I had to get done.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate to you again. Yeah. What happens when it all goes away? Those identities are very strong identities. And yes, yep. You have changed them multiple times throughout your life. You're in your 50s now. But what happens? Because that's a very scary thing. We talked about those guys that are around 40, 50 years. They're hooked to that identity of that job. What happens when this identity goes away?
I don't know. I wish I had the answer. I don't know. I'm not afraid because, again, I think, and again, I really, you know, I'm thankful for my time for Black Rifle because it gave me other set of skill, like, you know, the marketing, branding. I mean, I can talk to you about, you know, a little bit of, I can sprinkle a little bit of email marketing. I know social media marketing, right? I know event management, and there's things like that, that you're, if a cop does 40 or 50 years, he's not gonna know, or she's not gonna know, right? And so I was super fortunate now to have that skill set, you know. And again, one of the conversations that my wife and I had tonight was just that, though, too, was like, you know, well, you've been doing marketing for all this year, and then you're doing obviously Black Rifle. She's like, what about change something different? And I'm like, well, actually, at Pabst, I am. I'm not in marketing or branding. I'm just doing contracts for distributors. And she's like, oh, okay.
Well, but that tells you how strong that identity came through. Yeah. But I think that we went kind of around the question. What happens when that identity's gone?
I don't know. For me, I'll still be Dan Horgan. Like, I'm still going to smile, laugh. I don't think, and there's nothing wrong with it when I say this and I make the joke, I don't think I'm going to be the dude wearing the OES hat and the black sandals, right, and stuff like that. But I'll still, you know, be involved with other veteran groups. You know, archery was something, too, that I picked up, and that's what I would encourage other cops and people in the military, too. Like, try to start doing other things. But that's the thing. Archery, though, like, again, I look over, a lot of archery stuff is over here.
But you post a ton about archery.
Yeah. Well, and it's all sitting over here, but like, I literally can look, I have a multicam bag here. I got my arrows, but like, my quiver is tan from Kufaru, but the back little hump bag is multicam. I got a Sitka bag up there, but you know, that's a different camo, right? If when you're in your office, you need maybe a sport coat or something, if you were going to jump on some meeting. I don't do a sport coat, but I have my Black Rifle Coffee Tiger Stripe button up, like pearl snap shirt sitting over there in a hanger. It's my go-to if I have to wear a collared shirt in a meeting or something. But you have all these things around. Like, I got, you know, challenge coins sitting over here. You know, over here I have a picture when I was actually I was going through SWAT school. We did a lot of log PT.
It's called an I Love Me room. You did more than a wall. It's an I Love Me room.
Yeah, it's all over, right? And then stuff behind me. So this is, where am I at? So this is like my TAC-P class. Trying to point, that's my TAC-P class, my Baltimore patch, like in camo, right? That's a JTAC from, you know, Matt from the Battle Tribe. That's Sarah, Invader Girl.
Yep.
I'm backwards on that one. And that's more of Matt's stuff over there. There's my dog passed away, Ranger. That's his paw print there.
Here's what I worry about. And I'm talking from my perspective, and maybe it will resonate with you. What I worry about, though, in the end, and I've always tried to be very cognizant of it because I have three daughters. I talk about them on the show. I have two teenagers. One's going to be a teenager. And I always worry later on what they're going to think. Not necessarily what I did, because I think that it's fun to have all my stuff and to say I did this and say I did that and to have lived an exciting life. But I worry, are they going to say, I spent too much time on this show. I spent too much time researching. I spent too much time at work. And I don't always get it right, but I worry very much so in the end when I have grandkids, when they are married and stuff, when they look back on me, I worry what they're going to say.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. And my middle one, Matthew, he has his, right, he's a typical middle child, I guess, if you look at that, but like, I can see him, he gets angry quickly and stuff like that. And I'm like, and we have talks. I'm like, look, it took me 50 some years and all these crazy and dumb careers I had for me to have PTF, right? To get angry quickly. Like, you're 16. Like, what are you getting angry over is, yeah, actually, I don't want them to mirror me. Yep. So almost kind of what you're saying. So when I say that, like, taking those jobs that I did in Afghanistan, you know, for that year and a half, I mean, that was a solid year and a half. Again, it was money, but like, did I have to take that? Because I've not found something else. To, you know, again, even Black Rifle, right? Like, I did a lot of stuff. Did I have to go out to the ranch and stay till 6 or 8 p.m. on a Saturday if they were filming because, you know, I had to be there? Could I have left at some point? Oh, sure. But I think, and I would say with your daughters, I bet, and I think with mine, the way I look at it is, I look at it even too when people like meet me, like even if I left, like friends or people who didn't like me in a sense, say a Black Rifle, which hopefully weren't many, is that they won't be able to say, hey, look, you know, this guy was a slacker or, you know, this. They'll be able to say, look, he helped people, right? Like he, you know, was always there. He was, you know, a lend a hand, right? Type of person. So the same thing for my kids. Yeah, okay, dad, you know, wasn't here for this, or dad worked long hours, or even now too, right? Like, so I'm in here with you, but I had to look at them, and they did. They were like, where are you? Because they saw me with this, right? And they were like, where are you going? I go, I got to do a podcast. And then they're like, podcast, what? Right? But they know that I love them. Like, that's one thing that they will, like, they'll be able to say, like, you know, hey, he made it work, but like, I'm always there for, I wasn't always there. I mean, did I miss some games and stuff like that? Sure. But, you know, again, I think that they know that I love them. Well, my daughter, you know, we go down the rabbit on my daughter. So my ex-wife and I got divorced when Sarah was a year old and they moved to Florida, and Angie raised her in Florida. Now I took all my leaves this year, you know, but I gave her my post 9/11 GI Bill. So she went to college with my GI Bill. And then she's, you know, lives in New York City, and we don't talk that often, but she's an adult too. Now she's 28, right? So she's living her life, but we just don't talk often, but I would hope. And I mean, I don't know if she would listen to this or not, but it's like one of those hopes that she knows I love her, right? Like, hey, my dad wasn't there, but like, I know he loved me. Like I'm looking at, I got 2 pictures of my dad. And like I said, though, My dad and I were close, or weren't that close, but close enough. But I'm looking at those photos. So again, my mother worked 2 jobs to put me through that high school, right? She worked, my mother did. My dad didn't do shit really to get me through Calvert Hall. My mother did. But I still, like, I know he loved me, right? Now, I then try to do more than he did, especially even with my daughter Sarah being divorced. But my kids now, yeah, 100%. Like, paddleboarding to Bethany and I took a 10-day trip with her parents, with our youngest, Noah, out to California. Like, I never did that with my dad. I didn't do on a 10-day trip across country to California with my father. So there's going to be different stories that I think my kids will be able to look back and be like, okay, like, he might not have been there for every single thing, but he was there for a lot, and they know he loved me.
It's a question that always I like to ask people, because I think about it as I get closer and closer. I'm about 5 years out from retirement. As I get closer and closer to it, it's something that comes into my mind, like, okay, what's the next step? And I can't even imagine, and that's what interested me so much in coming after you to be on the show was, you continue to take these leaps and go, fuck it, let's just do it, and if it works out, it works out. Do you think that you're looking at it that way, or do you think that there's a different way that you're looking at it? Because it, to me, takes a lot of bravery to continue making those jumps.
Yeah, no, it's because I'm planning, you know. It's, I don't want to say, and I feel bad for the companies that I left, and I was never, I'm not planning to leave them too much, but I don't ever, and I'll just say it like that, right, to keep it kind of cryptic, I don't ever leave to not have something, again, other than that beer company. When I left that one, I didn't have anything. Like, that's why it took me 7 weeks. But again, I think using a platform like LinkedIn, you know, to promote LinkedIn as a platform, but even Instagram, I would tell you too, Instagram very much, like you keep, you know, a present, and there's networking, there's people to reach out to. There's always something, right? Like, so in, like I said, again, that beer company, when I, you know, still remember that call, you know, with the CEO, and I was just like, hey, this isn't working out. Like,
let's not talk about the company itself, but what was it about that particular thing that just, because I've never heard that in your story where just after 7 weeks, you're like, I mean, and we've talked, you jump around a lot. You're always looking for new adventures. But what was it about that that you were like, this is not it?
Personalities, man. Like, I can go negative. I try not to, but I could tell you there was personality, right? There was a little bit of personality conflict between myself and the CEO. And when I say personality conflict, I would even almost say it was expectations, right? Again, I tell you, I left in 67 days. Most places, 60 days, like you're just getting, like you're still trying to figure out what your email passwords are a little bit, right? Like, I know everyone says, I want to hit the ground running. Well, I can say that. Like, I mean, I helped get us, well, I got us in the burbiz. Like, I mean, I could rattle off stuff. So like I was doing things, but I think the expectations he had, again, to stay positive, but they are negative, I think they were a little bit unrealistic in a time frame, right? I can remember a call where he wanted a lot of things planned. Like, Dan, why aren't these being planned? Right? And I was like, I can plan them, but we're not going to be able to execute them. So it's just like, I'm like, why? Like, as in, like, we don't have the time frame. You're a startup. We're crowdfunded. Like, there are six of us here, dude. Right? Like, so I can plan something grand, and I can tell you now, side note, the things he wanted me planned, they still hadn't done. So even if I, as I'm saying, so I think it was just, but he was very like, why are we doing this? Why aren't we doing this? And it's just like, I said to him, and I remember because I told a friend, I was like, I cannot believe that dude didn't fire me, because it was before I quit. Like, I told him, I was like, do you know like what a marketing campaign is? Because he always wanted a campaign. And I was like, do you know what one like is? And he's like, yes, I do. And I'm like, what? No. And just, you know, and I just, we were butt heads on that to content. I was like, hey, you know, Budweiser, look at their Instagram page. And I was like, Budweiser has a huge staff. Like, I can't keep taking pictures of beer in my backyard or kitchen to suffice our media content, right? I think people, and this is where a little bit of a stigma came with me, I think, and I wouldn't say a stench, a smell, a stigma, is, hey, you were part of Black Rifle's success, which, again, when we say that, though, like, at this point, they had been 7 years. Like, they just went public. So I was in New York City on the stock exchange floor when we went public and stuff like that. But I was part of a team that helped that. Like, Dan Horgan just wasn't sitting there with Evan and Matt, and I did it. Like, I didn't do shit. Like, it was those guys. I was part of a team. And so people want to think they want that magic. They want that Black Rifle Coffee magic. Well, you're like, dude, that still took 7 years. We're in year one, going on year two. Like, go back to Black Rifle, what they looked like in year one and two. Like, that's what you have to expect. And so it even goes back to what I was saying about expectations. I believe there was a little bit of expectations of, well, I want what Black Rifle, you know, had. And you're like, all right, dude, like, I had $1 million budget for influencers. You get $1 million? Like, no, we didn't have it. Like, the answer was no. And so you're like, you can't get those results. And so it was a lot of expectations. So you add that all within 67 days. Like, it was just like, it was a pressure cooker. And I knew how I was at Black Rifle. And I, at this level, and I do air quotes, but I was the CMO for this startup. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I left Black Rifle. It was like, This offer was thrown at me, spread my wings. I mean, a military tribute beer company? What? Oh my God, like, we'll be able to crush this. Like, this is gonna be great. And after 2 months, it was just like, dude, like, this is not it. Like, I know what right looks like. And it was like, and this is not it. And, you know, and that's literally the phone call. I was like, hey man, like, I'm gonna bounce.
I gotta imagine, though, in knowing you and talking to you and stuff, that you had to have come strong with your game to them, though, telling them, this is what I bring to the table. This is what we can do. And do you think that there was maybe a miscommunication there? And the reason I'm asking that, let me ask you, though, the reason I'm asking you that is because of that point in your military career that we talked about where you were looking for a certain thing. They said no, and you said, fuck it, I'm out. Are we looking at the same kind of situation?
No, I'm a firm believer of, how make sure I say the saying right, like, under promise but over deliver versus the other, right? Because if you over promise and you under deliver, right, it's bad. No, so when I talk about my time at Black Rifle, right, I mean, I'm 100% truthful. Even when I right now, like, I made the comment, I had $1 million budget. Jess ran the influencers, and by definition, I was her manager, but that was like the influencer program. So it wasn't like I sat there and had $1 million, right? It was just me doing it. Again, there was a team for it. So when I talk, but I know these things. And so like same thing with emails. On Black Rifle, you know, they had 2 to 3 people just on the email marketing team, but like I know what it goes into. No, so I'm very candid when we talk about, I remember talking to the CEO, and it was during the Pennsylvania Total Archery Challenge last year. And I remember talking to him, and no, I mean, I'm like, but that's a thing though. Like you start throwing out, I'm a veteran, right? And so like he's not a veteran, and I'm coming from Black Rifle, and like, and again, all the people, the relationships that Evan had that I also then got to piggyback on, and people that I end up meeting, you know, Bert Soren, right? He's the owner of Sornex. Right, I got to meet Bert, and I kind of know Bert a little bit. You know, Josh Smith from Montana Knife Company. You know, I'm not like, I don't talk to these guys every day, but I'm sure if I hit them up on a message and I said, hey, it's Dan, they'd be like, hey, what's up? I think when I just tell these stories, and again, I think a little bit what you're saying, like it was for that guy. He's hearing these things, but his expectation is like, oh, like, you know, I'm going to be the next BRCC of, you know, beer, and it's going to be, you know, fabulous. And they're not doing bad. Let me just tell you, like, if you're following along with them, and again, I won't say their name, they just bought a brewery. So they're coming along. They're doing some stuff, you know, but their marketing, I still look at the marketing. Trust me. Like, I just can't. It's like breaking up with your girlfriend. Sometimes you got to, like, look to see what they're doing, you know, on their Instagram. I'm not impressed, right? I mean, Black Rifle is doing great. Like, they're still killing their media game and doing a lot of stuff. But for these guys, no, like, I'm like, okay.
All right, I got to ask you, in life, what's more important to you, the small things or the big things?
Yeah, in life, I'm not sure where you're going with it, because I know I've talked about caring about the little things. I think it's the little things in life to me matter, but, you know, they're all, but when I say the little things, like for me now, life, going to the pool today for my son would have been a little thing. Those matter to me. And I didn't do it, and not saying I didn't blow off work, but I would have had to blow off work a little bit to do it. And, you know, I just, it's Monday. And I, you know, didn't want to blow off work, but it is, I think it's those little things, you know, that matter. Yeah. I don't know. Like, you got me on that one.
Well, I know how you used to think, but I think it's different now. And when you mentioned the pool with your son, I don't think that's a small thing. I think that's a big thing.
It is,
because if they carry that forward as a big thing.
But I always talk about when I was in Afghanistan,
right?
And that colonel. Yeah, well, that's just for people when they're listening, if they have.
But what age were you then?
Oh yeah, that's that's 2011. I don't know. So what am I, like 38, 39 ish?
Okay, you're still not a youngster.
I'm immature. I'm immature now at 52. So you don't even know where, 35 to 38-year-old Dan, super immature.
The reason I asked that question was, yes, you did tell him, I can take care of the big things. You don't have to worry about the small things, because I'll take care of the big things. The reason I asked that question to you, though, is I want to know, has your opinion changed on that? Have those things switched around where now the small things count? Because when you add up all those small things, it comes out to a big thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, so when I use my son at the pool as an example, I don't know. I say that as small because it's the pool, like it's not mandatory, you know, so that's, you know, and I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, now though, I don't look at things big or small. So the military was so polarized to, you know, hey, your boots aren't bloused correctly, or your sleeves are cuffed in or not rolled right. And you're like, go screw yourself. Like, I'm dropping bombs. Let me worry about that. And then I'll worry about what my uniform looks like, versus now. Like, I don't have that. Like, my big things are, and even that aren't, like, I got to be at work at 9. Like, when I got to, so tomorrow morning, right? I got to be at work at 9. If I showed up at 9:05, it would be okay. Right. No one's getting shot at. No one's dying. Cause I showed up at 9:05. I'll stay to 5:05, you know, but that's about it. You know, now, like, you know, bills, you know, bills got to get paid. Okay. I mean, I have a side hustle that I do to make extra money. Like, if right now Paps were, if I were to walk in tomorrow and Paps is like, hey man, you're out. Yeah. Like, I'm losing an XYZ salary. Sure. but I still have, you know, something else. And then again, I think in networking, I'd have a plan to also then like, let's, you know, get some more clients and get it rolling back up.
So let's talk about transition, because you've had a lot of transitions in your life. I want to talk about, how was it throughout the military, throughout civilian life?
Yeah, I think throughout the military, like, so I did active duty almost 9.5, 10 years, and then reserves and guard, and then I was full-time guard. But my retirement's from the Oklahoma Air Guard. And I would tell you, like, when you leave the guard, you know, this was 2016, like, they didn't have that skill bridge program. And I don't even know if it goes for the guard. And so, you know, I almost equate the guard to police, because police really have zero, there's not really truly zero, but like enough zero compared to what like a military veteran has. So no, I really didn't, I didn't have any programs. I just took it upon myself. But again, I say I cheated. Like I started, that's how I started getting the contracting. All I did was just use my JTAC skills and, you know, was doing the ISR stuff, which is cheating really, right? You're just using your military job that they gave you and you're doing it, you know, in a capacity in civilian clothes. And so,
But isn't that cheating?
I say cheating. Like, you're still not, you still haven't transitioned. Like, I was in Afghanistan.
Okay. Like, I got it. Okay.
I was still in Afghanistan. I was still literally doing JTACery. Like, you know, even though I wasn't saying cleared hot, like, I was still on the radio, on the plane, and then eventually became the site lead and was managing all these people. But, you know, you're flying on the plane, talking on the radios, and looking at the surveillance ball. You're still just doing the same stuff. So that's why I say cheating is my term, but like you're just, you really haven't, I believe, transitioned. You're being a defense contractor.
Okay.
You know, there's guys, yeah, get right. I mean, these guys go from, you know, special forces to, you know, CIA and stuff. You're just like, you still haven't transitioned, dude. Like, you're still just doing that exact thing. It's not a bad thing if you can use that skill set in the civilian side, but you're still doing the same thing. Like, you haven't moved on. Like, still doing the same. He pays well, right? Defense, we know defense contracting pays well. I mean, it pays tremendous. It's great to truly transition. You know, it's like, I mean, even a cop, like if I were to retire, you know, people retire as cops and then they go and, I don't know, become a security guard. Work. Yeah. Right. Like
they do private security.
You're doing the same thing. And again, it's a bad thing, but it's like, you haven't transitioned. And transition, I guess, doesn't have to be a 180 change from what you were doing, but I came back and I was like, all right, like I'm done with Afghanistan. And I got on with an aviation company up in Oklahoma, a friend of mine. But again, I knew him and I still was doing the ISR work. But then eventually, like 6 months down the road, got out of that and then started working for the CEO. That's, I think, my true transition. And when I say that is because they wanted someone, and this was how my buddy Stan was like, hey, Daryl needs someone who's like a sergeant major, a first sergeant, right? But we don't know what to call it, but you'll work right for him and that's what you'll do. And so that's what I did. So we came up with the title senior analyst. I didn't analyze shit, but chief of staff, right? People get edgy over the word chief of staff for some companies. So we just came up with senior analyst. So I was the senior analyst to the CEO. But basically I was just acting like a first sergeant / sergeant major, if you know, for the company. But Daryl ended up, they were getting acquired and Daryl sent me to London. And so I got to go to London from the acquiring company. And then I was sitting in on board meetings. That right there, like sitting in the board meeting, which was pretty crazy because it was, I'm pretty sure it was that board meeting was, I got the call. I ignored my phone, right? You always have your phone off. And I ignored it. And I look and it was my stepmom. And she was like, call me. We take a break and I call her. I'm like, yeah, what's up? And she's like, your dad's dead. And I was like, great, sitting in a board meeting. That's like my first transition. Like I really like was getting into business, right? Going to London and meeting these, you know, the new, you know, company acquiring us, learning their SOPs, and then sitting in on board meetings, you know, back in the States for stuff is really when I got it. So I would even tell you, so that's when my wife, Bethany, when she was going to take these orders, because so she's guard and she was taking a spot down here full time in San Antonio. So we got PCS'd and I was just like, sure. Yeti, Grunt Style, Black Rifle are all like, right, or here. Like, they will pick me up in a heartbeat. Didn't happen as quick, but I think it was like 3 or 4 months is when I finally got my shot for Black Rifle. And then that transition is this continued, right? Coming from Oklahoma, because that was the job. The job literally, and it was again, early Black Rifle, right? The job description on Indeed literally said they were looking for a transitioning O3 that used to be a general's aide.
That sounds like you.
Yeah, well, I DM, that's my LinkedIn story. So I DM Scott Harvey. Scott Harvey used to be the COO. We were connected, but I didn't know him. But I message him. I direct message Scott, and I'm like, hey, sir, like, how about a combat E7 that's done that for a CEO of an aviation company? You know, that's what I did for Daryl. Got my interview, and I was hired like a week later.
Did you tell him, how about a first sergeant that got pissed off and got off of active duty and went into the guard?
Well, I think that's what they were looking for. So hindsight, always hearing the stories afterwards, Shane was, what was Shane's son? Shane was like the director of retail. And so Shane was a West Point graduate, lieutenant colonel from the Army, retired. And Shane got tasked for hiring this person for Evan. And the company had been without someone for about 30 days. So I think Evan was going crazy, and then the company was going crazy. So it was one of those, again, you know, risks, right? But like right place, right time, you know, me taking it upon myself to, A, I applied, but I think that little extra push with that message to Scott probably, yeah, I never asked Scott, but Scott, he's now the president of, he just became the president of Dunn Brothers Coffee. I'm sure Scott probably was like, Shane, I got a message from this guy. Like, look at his resume. And Shane probably looked at it like, okay, he's here in San Antonio, win, veteran, win, right? Combat. So I did what JT did, right? So the TACP crest that you have up there, JT was, you know, a TACP as well. You kind of add that in there. And then I come in the interview and I was prepared. So I believe I interviewed well. And this is I'll tell you, I didn't even interview with Evan or Tom. So Tom Davin's the co-CEO for Black Rifle. And so I was supposed to do stuff for Tom. Tom was born like a CEO. So I would 99% always just do stuff for Evan, but I did work for Tom by definition too. I didn't even interview with those guys. Like I interviewed with Shane and a contractor and I got hired. And yeah, 3.5 years.
All right. So let me ask you, in all your transitions, military, and we can even say National Guard, or excuse me, active duty to National Guard, police and civilian going in to Black Rifle, leaving that, transitioning into something else. Which was your hardest transition?
Leaving as being a police officer in 2010, going out to the Guard, I think was the most difficult because what I did is, so you gotta remember, so I'm in the Guard, right? As a TACP, as a JTAC, and then I'm a cop. I'm leaving Baltimore, so I'm leaving the Pennsylvania unit, but I'm going to Oklahoma. I went back to cheating. I ended up just being a guard bum for like, I think like a month or two, and then ended up getting a full-time slot. So when I say that was hard is because like I didn't have anything, you know, and you're sitting there leaving the police department and you're leaving the police department again with nothing. Like there's no money. There's no VA disability claim to do for a police officer, right? Because it's just the city. So there's none of that, you know, and there's no one reaching out to you. Like, so now actually I just am reading about and I'm trying to just poke because Sammy, she's a recruiter for Black Rifle. She's involved. There's a company called Cop to Corporate that I've seen on LinkedIn. And there was nothing like that. No one reached out to me, right? You leave the military. I mean, good God, right? There is from Skillbridge nowadays to, I mean, there's everyone and their grandmother reaching out to you. There wasn't any of that. So it was a very much, you know, naked and afraid, you're on your own, you know, but, and so being a planner who I am, taking what I know, I'm like, all right, well, I will always, you can always just go back to your military, right? Because I was still in the Guard. So that's a beautiful thing about the Guard. I mean, there's a lot of negative things too, right? But that's a beautiful thing that can move the Guard that I've seen it work for a lot of people is your civilian job tanks and you're in the Guard. Usually the Guard has maybe some kind of extra days and you guard bump, and that can save you. And that very much that did. Because if I wouldn't have had that when I left the police department, I wouldn't have, God knows what who knows? I have no idea what I would have done.
We know which one was the worst. Why is it so important to you now in this job that you have? Because you've stepped away from the military, you've stepped away from police, and you are a straight civilian now. You are a marketing guy. You work with all these different companies. Why is it so important to go back to that veteran? And now it sounds like you're even trying to get back into that law enforcement world and help these guys that are transitioning out. Why did that become a mission for you? And then when we're done with that, let's talk about the TACP Foundation, SOF missions, yep, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think when I say, I mean, it's important to me, it is. Because it's almost one of those, I'm not that it's cliche or not, I'm rambling. No one was there for me, I guess, right? Like, and I look at social media and people can laugh at LinkedIn and blah, blah, blah. I think like that platform, again, 2016, like when I got out of the Guard, but even when I left Baltimore, to 2010, that hard one, I didn't have anybody there, right? Like there was just, you know, podcasts, like there wasn't a thing. There was nobody there. So, you know, because my wife, she's not a big social media user, and she'll be like, why do you post all day, like for LinkedIn or once a day? And what are you doing? And you're like, and it's just a lot of people too. Like, I like networking. I like the people, but it's just like, if you help like one person, man, like, you know, and gets into your DMs and says something nice, but like it is helpful, you're like, yes. Because I can't look back during any of those times, especially the early times, right? The 2010s and stuff like that, where I had that at all. So it's just, you know, it's almost goes back to your military and police service is just trying to serve, right? Serve and help, keep helping others.
All right, let's talk about the TACP Foundation, and then we'll talk about SOF missions.
Sure. Yeah, the TACP Foundation and SOF missions. So just, you know, everybody's tracking. So I have an LLC I created during a little tenure there. It was December, what, of last year. You know, so I'm going to work for myself. And so I made a LLC. My buddy Dave Holland owns Long Tab Brewing, and his wife does yoga. And he was like, yeah, she used LegalZoom to build her thing. So I was like, great. So I just used LegalZoom and paid my $800 or $900. And I already had a logo for Free Range Texas, but I never knew what I was going to do with it. So I do like social media management. And so that's kind of where the transition. So TACP Foundation and SOF missions, I'm just, when I say running, I don't know. I mean, I'm creating their content and engaging on, you know, the LinkedIn and other platforms. And so each one of them, the TACP Foundation obviously is near and dear to me since it was, right, I was a TACP. So it helps out like the families, the Gold Star families, because we also have a TACP Association, which are different. Like we have the memorial side of the house for the fallen guys, and the association, right, has their mission. But like any nonprofit, you know, I would tell you, like when we talk about these, and so SOF mission, same thing. Like if you look at the Green Beret Foundation, you know, to the boot campaign, to, I mean, the Wounded Warrior Project, right? The Independence Fund. So Sarah's a friend of mine, you know, who runs the Independence Fund. These are multi-million dollar nonprofits. I mean, you have like, you know, 10 to 30 employees, right? So these, and full-time employees. And so you look at that, like, in order to get these donations, like these employees, like you have to have marketing, you have to have some kind of social media and content to have them. So the TACP Foundation never really did. And I talked to them and I was like, yeah, I mean, I'll help you out. I mean, but again, I can't do everything for free because I'm not a nonprofit myself. So there's a little bit of that. So they're part of, you know, my Free Range Texas LLC. And then same thing with SOF missions. Dr. Damon Friedman's the president for SOF missions, and that's based out of Tampa. And SOF does not stand for Special Operations Forces. It actually stands for Shield of Faith. So it's SOF missions, and it stands for Shield of Faith missions. And Damon does like the four pillars, psychological, you know, spiritual, like, so there's a lot of spiritual. If you notice, like, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, you know, I got Bible verses. We all slide and sin. Obviously, I drink beer and cuss. So there's that. But SOF missions has been around since 2011. Damon would kill me. Yeah, pretty sure 2011 is when he created it. He was a Marine, and then got out of the Marines and went into the Air Force. And he was an officer. So he was a Lieutenant Colonel. I think when he got out, he was in charge of one of the Special Tactics Squadrons. So he was a Special Tactics officer. So he's done some pretty cool stuff. And he goes around and does some national speaking, but SOF Missions, his nonprofit, is based out of Tampa, and he flies people in, you know, guys and gals, veterans and active, to go through his program down there in Florida. But their big thing is it's the aftercare. Like, so it's not just let me do this stuff with you this week. There's a lot of the aftercare that they continue on with, and he's got some big things coming with there. So yeah, so I have those two nonprofits that I kind of do their social media. So if you look at the social media and you think it's crap, great, that's me. If you're thinking that it's not too bad, right? Well, I would
Way
say,
to sell it.
well, the Top Tee Foundation, an easy one when I say that, because I go on to the DVIT, right, the government website, and I can type in TACP, ASOS, A10, JTAC, stuff like that. So I pull a lot of photos from there because it is for our TACP career field, but you know, also the families too, sure. So it's that military. So it's I don't want to say it's easy, but that one's easy. Compared to with Damon, SOF Missions. So SOF Missions doing his SOF Missions, it's like it has a military flair to it, but I can't pull, you know, a guy talking on a radio like a JTAC that the TACP community wanted to see. You know, you really got to dig into, am I giving a spiritual fitness message? Or are we going to talk about, you know, a suicide awareness message to, you know, physical health, right? Working out kind of stuff, which he, you know, he does as well with that. So that one's a little bit more, and I say tricky, just going down the realm of, you know, we were talking earlier for marketing and social media. It's not just take a photo and type in some words, man, and you're
Right.
viral. Like you really, like, I would tell you, like, seriously, go on LinkedIn and look at up SOF Missions, you know, their content. I work with, now here's the thing, I work with Damon and his team. I'm usually crafting a lot of this, and then they can review it and be like, oh, let's, you know, we, you know, we can talk about things. But I would tell you, just like with the TACP Foundation, and it was, and again, and I'll even, this is a soapbox of mine because I saw it at Black Rifle, is there's a level of trust, there's a level of being on brand. And so the team over at the TACP Foundation and the team at SOF Missions, which is why I love doing it for them, give me a lot of freedom on the creativity side because they know I'm going to be on brand, right? I'm going to craft a message, whether it's one of the three, right? Inform, inspire, entertain, right? If I'm staying in there and I'm, you know, hitting like the subjects again, and like with any nonprofit or even business, you know, trying to help broaden their brand awareness. And what does broadening brand awareness do? Hopefully gains donations, right? So that's, you know, what I try to do without being salesy, right? If you can gain followers, if you can gain impressions. Now I'm not privy to that side of there. Like I don't ask and they haven't ever told me. I would tell you, like, hey Dan, that post, right? Oh my God, our donations went up, you know, $5 million. I don't know any of that.
No news is good news.
Well, yeah, I would hope they come back. I mean, I know, but that is a goal. It's what, but again, but brand awareness, and again, Black Rifle doesn't occur overnight. I mean, even Liquid Death, I would say Liquid Death, right? They're, whew, right? They're skyrocketing. It's not overnight. It's still taking time.
It's my favorite water.
It is, right?
It's amazing water.
They're doing
Everyone
great
makes
stuff.
fun of me, but it's amazing water.
No, they're doing great stuff. But again, it's not overnight. I mean, it
Right.
could be quick, but it's still, yeah, not overnight. And daily, they're having to keep doing it. You can't ever just take a rest.
Right. All right. So, what's next for you? I know there's something on the horizon.
Well, I would tell you, I mean, I'm still Pabst. So, yeah, I mean, I'm at Pabst. Pabst is a fabulous company. My mom, I don't know if you saw, but if people are listening, my mom was visiting. She fell, I'm laugh, but she fell off my front steps, which are two steps, knocked herself unconscious, had like seven staples, 7 or 10 staples put in the back of her head, had to go to the ER. I mean, it was, she stayed in the hospital 2 or 3 days, and then I had to fly back out to Maryland. I just started with Pabst. They have unlimited PTO from day one. My mom's visit, I'm 2 weeks into it, and I gotta fly her back. Like, I can't let put a 72-year-old on the plane with staples in her head, right? And then she lives alone in Maryland. So, you know, my boss, I was like, hey, Alan, I gotta take my mom back to Maryland. Like, I'm gonna be gone for like 5 days. He's like, yep, you got PTO, put it in. Yeah, but
Wow.
I was worried for my military time because, again, I tell a story. I had to go to work the night my daughter was born, right?
Right.
So to give me 5 days off, I mean, he's like, it's unlimited PTO. Like, you just started. Like, you're not necessarily missing anything. But it was like, yeah. But I feel like such the weirdo there at PAPS because my military, they don't have a big veteran, you know, military crew there. And trust me, I can tell, like, I'm wearing my MAC belt actually into work. And like, I'm trying to show it off and people don't know my, I'm really happy with my new phone case, right? It's a multicam. It's super cool. No one
MAC
cares.
Belts, greatest belts on earth. We're going to talk about them in just a minute.
Yeah, there they are. No, but no one cares, right? I got a Baltimore police patch on my picture on my desk. They could care less. And it's not anything negative, but it's just the fact where I act, again, so police and so military a little bit, where it's just like, yeah, none of that here, Dan.
All right. Where can people find you if they want to get a hold of you, if they want to look into you, if they want to hear a little more of your story?
Yeah, LinkedIn's always the big thing. Like, that even stuck with me when I was a Black Rifle. Richard Ryan's one of the guys who started it with the crew. And Richard used to, he does a Vets React that I was on. And Richard used to be like, Dan is our LinkedIn influencer. I'm not. I just like that platform. So I'm on LinkedIn. Dan Horgan. It's this face right here. It's not a 1980s photo. I am in a tie, though, right, on that picture. Instagram is Dan_Horgan_. It's a little bit funnier picture, but again, it's this face. I think I'm in a background of blue bonnets here in Texas. Yeah, and then, I mean, I have a Facebook, but I use that just for work. So it's not really a ghost account, but I don't do anything with it. That's about it. I got on Threads, but I haven't even looked at it like in 2 weeks. I don't know where that went. Yeah, I really love LinkedIn and Instagram. I think for like an Instagram as a brand, I mean, some of the photography and video out there, man, it is phenomenal. Like the professionals, the guys that are, that right, do photography, like, are just incredible work, man. And it is some good stuff. I mean, like, you know, Matt, you know, and Sarah, you know, so Battle Tribe and Invader Girl, you know, so that's Sarah. So Invader Girl, like, her art, like the stuff that they just on that, like, so, and then like Sarah's gotten actually big on LinkedIn. She's been putting her stuff up. And I think she found, she's like, hey, there's people on this platform that aren't on this platform that will probably buy my artwork.
Matt's got law enforcement background too, NYPD. So
yep, retired. Yeah. Yep, he retired.
Yep.
And I got to meet Matt twice out at SHOT Show. Good, great guy.
I was him and I talk every once in a while. Yeah, okay. I was at a gala with Sarah about 2 months ago.
Oh, were you? Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. So
yeah, so I actually, it was, it's funny again, the LinkedIn thing when I talk about Sarah. So Damon, like I think I commented on one of her photos, and Damon Freeman writes for SOF. He saw it, and then he ended up, I think his wife got him a custom print.
Yeah. Awesome artwork.
Yeah. Like then this one, you're pointing at, right? That one Matt did, that one's actually not for sale. That's the JTAC one with the A10, but Matt signed it and sent it to me.
Oh, wow. Awesome. This has been a great story. We've been kind of all over the place, but I kind of feel like that's been your life, just all over the place. And that's what makes it so interesting to me. Guys, you know where you can find Dan. Let's talk about where you can find me. As always, you can find me on Instagram at @DTD_podcast. You can find me on Facebook at @DTD podcast. And you can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations, they're in video form. But your one-stop shop, it's DTDpodcast.net. Audio, video, pictures of Dan, pictures of his career, links that you can find him if you just want to talk to him and send him a message. It's all going to be right there on his episode page. Now that we know where we can find me, let's talk about my amazing sponsors. Dan just brought one up, MAC Belts. Yeah. Greatest belt in the world, toughest belt in the world. My friend Mac Alexander over there at MAC Belts. We all know that nothing stands up to wear and tear like a good leather belt. If you're looking for the toughest leather belt on earth, then you've come to the right place. MAC Belts. They're handcrafted in the USA, and it's by veterans who are serious about their craft. If you're looking for a belt that's tough enough for your active lifestyle and help support those who've given so much to our country, look no further than the MAC Belts. It's the toughest belt on the planet. And tonight, we usually talk about the belts, but let's talk about the buckle. It consists of 100 plus grams of unbreakable American stainless steel. It's engineering, designed, assembled, and machined in the USA by USA built machines. It's very important to MAC to keep everything right here in the US. Backed by a multi-generation warranty, expertly engineered to combine modern precision for rugged use. Now, the MAC belt and the brushed steel D-ring can be added to any MAC belt for a discounted price or purchased separately. You know what belt goes great with Mack buckles? All of them. It's the limited edition Kalahari belt, but any other ones go great with it. They're hand-cut, veg-tan, full-grain saddle leather, and they're dyed to a classic saddle tan. Now, I get mixed up with my words about it because there's so many different Mack belts out there. They have all different kinds, thick ones, thin ones, anything that you might want to use them for. Mack belts has you covered. MackBelts.com. Now let's talk about coffee. We said about some other company, but let's talk about the most badass coffee company ever. Police Coffee. It's an officer-owned business, and it's dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends, and they're shipped as soon as they're made to provide you with the freshest coffee available. Each batch, it's roasted fresh by people who know what it means to stay vigilant, and their specialty coffees do not waste one drop when flavor's concerned. Their coffee's some of the best you'll find, but it also helps serve an important cause. They give back to our community. Remember, 50% of their profits go towards helping family members of police officers who fell in the line of duty. And if you want to talk about flavor, my favorite one, One Ranger. It's flavorful, medium-bodied coffee with a smooth and sweet pecan flavor. You're from Texas, Dan, and you would agree, pecan coffee, it's probably one of the best combinations in the world. It's rich, sweet, nutty, and buttery, and its flavor cuts right through coffee's natural acidity to give you a smooth and satisfying coffee experience. Make sure you go to policecoffee.com. They have whole bean, ground, K-cups, dog treats. They have anything that you could possibly need to have coffee, including mugs. Make sure you go to them, policecoffee.com. DJK10 will give you 10% off your order. Please help out our sponsors, Mack Belts and Police Coffee. MackBelts.com, PoliceCoffee.com. They make this show possible. Guys, that's going to be it for this week. Dan, I'm so happy that you came in, that we got to talk about this. We got to go over this crazy life. Make sure you stay up with us for the next one. We'll catch you later. That's Dan. I'm DJ. This has been the show. We're out of here.
Thanks, DJ.